All right, today I'm joined by Dr. Tim Ball. Dr. Ball, thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, James.
All right. Dr. Ball, could you just start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background with climate science?
Well, I was born in England, immigrated to Canada, and was in the Canadian Air Force for 9 years, where I got my first training and learning about the weather and climate, and then lost my flying category and got out of the military and went back to university and ended up getting a PhD in climatology from the University of London, England, Queen Mary College, and taught the subject for 25 years and also researched and published in the area. And since retirement, I've continued to publish continue to work in the area of climate. And then, of course, I guess the interesting thing for me is that my career spans two climate cycles. When I started out, global cooling was the scientific consensus. Now we're into global warming, and in my opinion, we're just starting on a cooling phase again. So looks like I'm going to span three climate changes.
Interesting. Can you tell us some of the sources that I've seen on the internet about you have listed you as a global warming skeptic, but can you clarify that term for the listeners? Do you actually believe that global warming is not taking place?
No, first of all, scientists should be skeptics. That's the very definition for me of a good scientist, is somebody who's constantly seeking the truth, and you don't accept anything at face value. As I just said, the climate fluctuates all the time. It depends on what length of period of the record you look at as to what trend you want to argue for. For example, since 1998, the world's cooled down, which is why they've switched from talking about global warming to talking about climate change. From about 1985 or so to 1998, the world warmed up, and that's when this global warming hysteria began. Prior to that, from 1940 to 1985, the world cooled down and the consensus was cooling. Prior to that, it warmed up. And longer term, it's been warming since about 1680, which was the nadir of a period called the Little Ice Age. And, of course, what's interesting is that I've been saying that all my career and going around saying, look, the climate changes all the time. But people call me a climate change denier and a global warming skeptic. And then it became even nastier little over a year ago. I guess it was the first time I saw it. The Times in England referred to me as a climate change denier, which is to say is ludicrous, because I've been saying exactly the opposite thing. But, of course, it has all the Holocaust connotations of that term. And it's a measure of how political this issue has become. So, as I say, pick your period of record and argue whatever trend you want to argue, because the climate's changing all the time.
Okay. From the media reporting earlier this year, it seemed that the scientific consensus through the IPCC report was that human causation was a significant factor in global warming. What do you say to that IPCC report?
Well, the IPCC report is probably one of the worst reports produced, and certainly the most political. That whole organization has been political right from the start. Most of the people on it, and it started out with 3,000 people, very few of whom are actual scientists, and certainly even less who are climate scientists, is now dwindled down to, I think the last number I saw was 300. And the number that actually participated in the most recent report were 40, although they pretended to invite guest contributors. I'm just reading stuff on my computer right now about many of the people that were invited to contribute. None of their stuff was used. In fact, they didn't even get acknowledgments of receipt of their stuff. So the IPCC report is a most incredibly flawed document. And you see that in the whole structure of how it was set up. The way they set it up in their own rules state that they do the technical or science report, that's set aside, and then the political group move in and write what's called the summary for policymakers. And it then goes back to the technical or science group to make sure that the technical science group report matches what the policymaker group have said. In other words, it's like an executive of a corporation writing an executive summary of a report and then telling his employees to make sure the report that they produce reaches the conclusions that he has or she has in the executive summary. It is that bizarre. And of course, that's the whole political process of IPCC. The argument about the number of people involved, of course, is meaningless. Consensus is not a scientific fact. And you can argue all you want. I mean, I could say to you, well, what about the Oregon petition where 19,000 scientists have said they don't accept the global warming thesis? It's meaningless. What you have to look at is the facts, the evidence, and understand it. And one of the problems that you have with climate is that it is a generalist discipline. For example, when you stand outside and experience weather, which is the day-to-day variation of things, you're experiencing what you experience is the sum total of everything from cosmic radiation in deep space to geothermal heat from the bottom of the ocean and everything in between. And so to sort out each of the individual components that make up that weather, we simply can't do it. And then how that weather changes day to day or over time or in a region is climatology. So what you have is climate is actually a generalist discipline in a world that glorifies specialization. And so when you look at the people that make up the IPCC as an example, you might get one person who's, say, an expert in methane or another one who's an expert in plant physiology or some part of that, and so on. But in terms of how putting that into the whole picture of climate, it is a completely different issue. And where you see them running into problems with this is in the computer models, because the people who have dominated climate science for the last 20 years or more are the computer modelers. Very few of them with any expertise in atmospherics, in meteorology, or climate, and yet they've dominated the whole thing. And in fact, the sole proof that this latest IPCC report presents of a human signal is simply coming out of a computer model. And so that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but I think it puts the whole concept in perspective.
Well, it certainly does. And certainly the climate as a whole is difficult to model, as you say. But as viewers of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth movie might remember, it seemed that the ice core data showed that there was a direct link between CO2 levels and temperature. So what do you say to that evidence?
Well, that's the interesting part about this whole thing. And first of all, by the way, I think what Gore is doing is absolutely shameless. And it's appropriate that he got a Oscar for it, because Oscars come from the land of make-believe. That whole movie is make-believe. Even James Hansen, who's a great supporter of his from NASA, said, well, Al got the science, a lot of the science wrong, but the message is what's important. Well, sorry, no, that's not the way science works. But the ice core data, the whole politicization of climate and climate studies has focused on CO2, and particularly the human portion of CO2. And of course, Gore wanted to have that very heavily shown in his movie. And I think there's political motives for that, by the way. And Gore's comment in the movie that CO2 is the most important greenhouse gas is wrong for the wrong reason. Only Gore could get a double negative. It's the most important greenhouse gas. It isn't the most important greenhouse gas, I should say. Water vapor is by far. It is an important greenhouse gas because without it, the plants don't grow. And without the plants, there's no oxygen, and therefore there's no life on Earth. So, as I said, it illustrates how little Gore understands anything. But the ice core record came out back in the 80s, late 80s, with Jouzel and others And here it showed this, when they plotted out the gases in the ice bubbles, and by the way, there's all sorts of problems with that, with how they do that, but it showed the temperature going up and down based on oxygen 18-16 isotope ratios, and it showed the CO2 going up and down, apparently in concert with it. And it also, by the way, they also had deuterium and other things, but they never get mentioned. And the people that came out with this said, look, don't rush to judgment on this. The same thing as the people that discovered the so-called hole in the ozone. But immediately they leapt to all sorts of conclusions about it. And now we know, and even the people that are advising Gore, and this is where Hansen would have been one of his comments about Gore getting the science wrong, we know that in the ice core record, the temperature changes before the CO2. Not as one of the most fundamental assumptions of the hypothesis of CO2, and particularly human CO2 driving climate change. So, but of course, what's amusing about it is Gore puts it up on his chart in the movie and doesn't mention that. And of course, what he doesn't mention also is that all of the computer models still are built around the concept that if the CO2 goes up, the temperature goes up, when the ice core record shows exactly the opposite. So and I guess my comment about all of this, James, is that if the differences between what I know as a climate scientist and what is being put out there, if the differences were small, and I like to remind people that the term we use for that is that if the differences were academic, which essentially means they're of little relevance to the real world, and I think a lot of the university people should think about that. But if the differences were small, I wouldn't even be speaking out. But the differences are huge, and particularly large, especially when entire global policy is being based on this. So, for example, the global policy in every country in the world, at the UN, everywhere you look, is to prepare for warming, when in fact the world's cooling down, and the evidence is that we'll continue to cool until at least 2030 as the sun's activity declines. It's being completely ignored. And so we're preparing for completely the wrong thing, thanks to this politicization and of what is going on in the climate science.
So I think you just hinted at it there, but if CO2 isn't driving temperature, then what is?
Well, what's driving the weather and climate is the sun. You can't pick up any textbook on physical geography or climate or weather or meteorology, and meteorology, by the way, is the physics of the atmosphere, you can't pick up any textbook where the opening line, isn't it, the source of energy for the whole planet is the sun. Now, that's not correct in the sense that, as I mentioned earlier, there's geothermal heat, that is heat coming from within the Earth, and the amount that's going into the oceans, I think, is a significant amount that's being ignored, all the volcanic activity. But anyway, no, the sun is the major thing. In the computer models that the IPCC use, they only look at one component of the sun's of how the sun changes the climate, and that is what's called the electromagnetic spectrum, the heat and light. And they argue, well, it varies very small variation, and therefore it's not significant. But even with their own computer models, they acknowledge that it explains, quote unquote, over 50% of the supposed 0.6 degrees Celsius increase in temperature in the last 130 years, which doesn't leave much for CO2. But the other parts of the sun's change that are left out, the major one is the Milankovitch effect, and I say major because on a long term, I mean, I'm talking now 90, you know, thousands of years, it is the major cause of temperature change and therefore climate change. The Milankovitch effect is that the orbit of the Earth around the sun is constantly changing. And contrary to what the textbooks are still telling most students, the orbit of the Earth is not a fixed small elliptical orbit. And what's amazing to me about this is we've known for 150 years that's not true, but it's still being put into the textbook or into the school books and textbooks. It's caused the orbit of the Earth around the Sun is changed by the gravitational pull of the planet Jupiter. Right now we happen to be almost circular, and 22,000 years ago we were more extreme ellipse. So what I'm telling you is that every single year the orbit changes slightly, which means the climate changes slightly. On top of that, the tilt of the Earth is not 23.5 degrees, that's simply a close enough, as I like to joke, is close enough for government work, but the tilt changes, and I'm not talking about the wobble's different to, on top of this, but the tilt of the Earth changes from 24.4 to 21.8 degrees all the time. So every single year the tilt is different, which means that the climate's going to be different, the area under the Arctic Circle and Antarctic Circle and so on. And so that has a significant effect upon climate, particularly over longer periods of time. And then you've got something called the precession of the equinox, that is the dates on which the equinoxes occur. Now we know this intuitively in the sense that our calendars are rigid, but the Earth and the Sun-Earth relationship is changing all the time, and if we don't change the calendars, then they get out of date. But for some reason, people don't make that connection, and it certainly isn't made in the climate field. And what's interesting about all of this is the Milankovitch effect has been known about since 1950. As I mentioned, the orbital changes for 150 years. A fellow by the name of James Cole was looking at it 150 years ago as its effect on climate. And the tilt's been known about for 130 years. None of that is included in the IPCC computer models. And Weaver, who is one of the lead authors on that chapter, argues, oh, well, it's too small and too long a time scale. Well, sorry, year by year, and if you're making a prediction for 100 years, it does become important. And the third change in the Sun that is not included is that we know that that there's a very, very high correlation. And I've got to be careful here, correlation is not necessarily cause, but there's a very high correlation between number of sunspots and the temperature on the planet. And basically the way it works is that when there are very few sunspots, the Earth is cooler, and when there are a lot of sunspots, the Earth is warmer. And the little ice age that I mentioned earlier that centered around 1680, it happened to be in a period when there were virtually no sunspots recorded, a period called the Maunder Minimum. And that Maunder Minimum correlates with the Little Ice Age that I talked to you about. And the predictions about cooling for the next 30 years till 2030 are based on the fact that solar activity is declining, the sunspot numbers are declining, and the solar experts anticipate that by 2030 will be a pretty low number of sunspots, and therefore will be in a cooler phase of global temperature. None of that is in the computer models. None of it is discussed in the IPCC reports because it doesn't fit their CO2 model.
Okay, and perhaps you can correct my science on this, but my understanding is that the theory of anthropogenic global warming predicts that the rise in temperature will take place first in the troposphere, as the greenhouse gases capture the solar radiation on their way back, reflected back into space. But the actual observed finding is that the warming is taking place on the surface. Would the theory of solar cycles account for the fact that the observed warming is taking place on the surface rather than in the troposphere?
Yeah, those are good questions, James. You've done your homework. Well done. One of the things I think, first, before I answer your question specifically, is that people must realize that anthropogenic global warming, or AGW as it's now abbreviated to, is a theory or a hypothesis. The hypothesis was that because humans produce CO2 and the amount we're producing is increasing, the atmospheric level of CO2 would increase, and that because if CO2 goes up, the temperature goes up. Well, we've already discussed how the ice core record shows that's not true. What happened with that hypothesis was that it was accepted as a fact before this the research began. And Richard Lindzen said that 20 years ago. He said that the consensus was reached before the research had even begun. And based on the, again, their computer models, they made all these predictions about tropospheric warming and so on and so forth. Every single prediction that those computer models have made has been wrong. And the tropospheric warming is one of those. I think there's also a serious question. In fact, I know there's a very serious question about the quality of the surface record. The satellite shows a different record. I know they're claiming now that they're the same, but they're really not. But the surface temperature record from which Phil Jones at the Climatic Research Unit, he's the guy that came out and said the world's warmed 0.6 degrees Celsius in the last 130 years. What bothers me about that is that we've got very, very few records that go past even 100 years. So I'd love to know what he's using for a global, to come up with a global figure. And also, he's refusing to disclose which stations he used, and he's refusing to disclose how he adjusted those stations, because I know from my own research, starting in 1972, and I wasn't the first to do it, a fellow by the name of Chandler in London in 1952, was studying what's called the urban heat island effect. Now, this is the idea that because of the concrete, the change of the surface, the heat generated from buildings and from people, and the reduction of vegetation, the cities are warmer than the surrounding countryside. And as I said, Chandler did the first studies in London in 1952. The concept had been discussed by Kratzer in the Ruhr Valley in 1933, but he was looking at it more from the point of view of pollution. And the studies I did in Winnipeg with Steve Ladashi and others in 1972 showed the dramatic temperature changes between the airport and the center of the city, a distance of just 8 kilometers. Now, we know that every single city, therefore, has an influence on the its own temperature and for a short area around it. And since most of the weather stations were built on the edge of the cities in the 1930s as aviation became commercial, and then the cities grew out around the weather stations and have seriously distorted the temperature record. And Warwick Hughes has got a marvelous study that he did back in about 2000 for Australia, where he plotted the temperature for 6 Australian cities. And you see, starting about 1950, as the car allowed the city and the suburbs to grow, the temperature starts going up. And it was of course, they really said, oh, that's global warming due to humans. And but then he plots 27 rural stations in Australia that show virtually no trend at all. And so the surface record, which ostensibly showed a dramatic global warming, wasn't showing that at all. It was showing the influence of the urban heat island effect. And now we've got the problem that the actual amount of that urban heat island effect is not being applied properly to correct the surface temperature record. And that's part of the reason why what the satellite is showing, because it covers the whole globe, is different from the surface record.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Let's move a little bit from the science more into the political aspects of this. Earlier you mentioned Al Gore. And also, you've been quoted in the Canadian Free Press as telling Fox News' Hannity and Combs that the current hysteria over man-made global warming goes back to Maurice Strong, who is kind of an enigmatic Canadian figure who is often considered one of the architects of the Kyoto Accord. Can you tell us a little bit more about Maurice Strong and his role in the creation of this myth?
Well, the most remarkable thing, here's a farm boy from Oak Lake, Manitoba, in the center of Canada, and with very little education. I'm not sure what he's got, grade 10, I believe. And he went off to the U.S. and got into industry and made a pile of money in industry, and then decided that he was going to become an environmentalist, and he had the money to be able to afford to do it. I think that is what the British call the champagne socialists. So we have these champagne environmentalists. And Maurice Strong got involved with, and he was one of the originators of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, at the Lash in 1988. and of course was the architect of the 1992 Rio conference, which with all the NGOs and all the other environmental groups involved. And so Maurice Strong, and I recommend to your listeners that one of the better coverages of Strong and his input is in a book called The Cloak of Green by Elaine Dewar, D-E-W-A-R. And Elaine started, she was a journalist, and started to look at, wanted to write a book in praise of environmentalists like Maurice Strong, and started her research and ended up writing, realizing, you know, what these people were up to, and wrote an absolute damnation of them. And about 20% of that book is devoted to Maurice Strong and his machinations. And so Strong, of course, then had control at the UN. He was the advisor, senior advisor to Kofi Annan. And then, of course, he suddenly disappeared now because his son, as with Kofi Annan and all the rest of them, had their hands in the Iraq oil and all that other rubbish. So Maurice Strong is more than an enigmatic figure. He was put in charge of the Petro-Canada in Alberta and virtually brought it to its knees. He was made the chair of Ontario Hydro, and Ontarians are paying the bill for the damage that he did there, and they're going to pay the bill for a long time in terms of not having adequate energy for what they need in their development. And of course, what annoys me about all of that is the federal government of all stripes spending billions on climate change, thanks to advice from Mr. Strong, and meanwhile, they're not dealing adequately with the pollution in southern Ontario, where Strong was, in charge of Ontario Hydro. So he's one of these people like Al Gore, who, looking for vehicles for whatever reason, not understanding the science, and using fear and using emotion. And Gore, of course, with his pure propaganda movie, is a classical example of it. And they just run roughshod over everybody. And I think that H.L. Mencken, an American political commentator, who I used to think was a little too cynical, but the more I see, the more I think he's right on the money. He said over 60 years ago that the urge to save humanity is almost always a false front for the urge to rule. And I think that applies to Gore, and it certainly applies to Maurice Strong. And, of course, Strong is now involved in a company with George Soros to import cars from China. So he continues with those capitalist ways. And of course, we've seen all of the hypocrisy of Gore with his carbon footprint and everything else. And, of course, what we don't hear enough about is the amount of involvement that these people have in the carbon trading companies. And of course, carbon trading and carbon credits is, I hope this doesn't sound like a bad pun, but it's the worst shell game that's going on today. It's like Kyoto. It's the idea that somehow this would reduce CO2 in the atmosphere when it wouldn't do anything of the sort, wouldn't change it one bit, but it allowed people to make money. And you go and look at the Chicago Climate Exchange and who's on the board of directors, Maurice Strong. And you go and look at Al Gore and what's he got his investments in, carbon trading credit companies, and yet they have the audacity to point the finger at other people and their investments and their vested interests and everything else. And I basically, I could summarize it by saying, hypocrisy, thy name is Gore and Maurice Strong.
Well, certainly I think the anthropogenic global warming theory is being politicized. And I think that's evident from people like Mr. Gore and Mr. Strong. And also, as I'm sure you're aware, there are numerous sites dedicated to attacking you on the internet. What is...
Yeah, by the way, the one that does attack me is this Smog Blog. And I almost don't want to mention it to give your readers a Russian look at it. But that, by the way, is funded by James Hagen. And Hagen is on the board and was director of the David Suzuki Foundation here in Canada. And so you want to start talking about vested interests. They argue that I'm paid by the oil and gas companies. The only tenuous connection they could make was that when David Anderson was Minister of the Environment here in Canada, and he came out, as they all do, with this stupid statement that they're going to stop climate change, and well, what a laugh that is. And Anderson said, we consulted all the Canadian climate experts on for Kyoto. Well, eight of us that were not consulted one bit, including myself, went to Ottawa and said, hey, we weren't consulted. And a group that I helped set up called Friends of Science, which were a group of very angry, very upset, very disaffected, a group of professional people, hydrologists, geologists, and others, formed the Friends of Science to try and focus on the science and get these politicians out of it. They paid for my expenses to go to Ottawa, which happened to be $800. And it turns out, unbeknownst to me, because we got the money put into a blind trust through the University of Calgary, but apparently a small portion of that money, an extremely small portion of it, came from the oil companies. So they're claiming, therefore, that part of the $800 I received in expenses to go to Ottawa was payment by the oil companies to me to speak for them. It's the most incredibly rubbish thing you can imagine. But that's what's going on. And, of course, it suits the David Suzuki Foundation. And of course, what people need to ask themselves with all of these things is, why the personal attacks? Why don't you answer the questions? Why don't you explain the science to me? Why don't you answer my questions instead of attacking me personally? And any philosopher will tell you that personal attacks, or ad hominem attacks as they're properly known, are a sure sign that you're losing an argument, that you want to divert from the issues. And of course, that's what's going on here.
Well, I certainly wish climate scientists could be purchased for a portion of $800, because I could buy a few of my own in that case.
There you go.
But undoubtedly, there is a political aspect to this. But what do you see as the greater political agenda being pushed by the people of anthropogenic global warming?
That's a very, very good question, and one that I've been addressing a lot lately, although it's not getting out there much. And part of the reason, by the way, it's not getting out there is because the public, and Gore is an example of it, that understand the weather and climate very, very little of it. For example, most people don't know that the atmosphere is heated by the ground, not by the sun. The sun heats the ground initially, but that, and so fundamental stuff like that. But the answer to your question is, and of course it's that old question, well, what's your agenda? You know, everybody's got to have an agenda. I believe that the agenda is wrapped up in a statement by our friend Maurice Strong, when he said that the problem, the planet's problem, are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our duty to get rid of them? Now, the industrialized nations exist because of energy. You'd be foolish to attack energy, because the public would react right away. And you've got proof of that with the gasoline prices going up. Immediately there's an outcry. But you can shut an engine down in two ways, and the engine, the industrial engine, you can squeeze the gas line, which I just said they wouldn't do, or you can plug the exhaust. And the exhaust, the byproduct of that industrial engine, is CO2. And so if you can point at CO2 as causing the ultimate destruction of the planet, then you effectively shut down those industrialized nations. And of course, in an ironic way, many of the countries of the world, in fact most of them, saw that if they implemented Kyoto, it would have a very serious effect on their economy and jobs. And from a political point of view, they weren't willing to pay that price. So the focus on human CO2 is actually a focus upon the industrial nations, the industrial activities, and wrapped up in Maurice Strong's statement. Now, what happened, of course, was then this attack upon industry and businesses, where you see that the companies are bullied into silence and sort of playing games of pretending to be green and all the rest of it, to simply to avoid the pressures, and the politicians doing the same thing. It's absolutely backfiring, and it's attacking the wrong issue completely. And so, and the reason I'm saying it's the wrong issue is what I mentioned earlier, that CO2 is absolutely crucial to life on Earth. And by the way, at 385 parts per million, which is an estimate of the current level of CO2 in the atmosphere, and I say that because the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere fluctuates tremendously from day to day, week to week, and year to year, that's low. All the research shows that plants function best between 1,000 and 1,200 parts per million. And in fact, commercial greenhouses pumping up to 1,000 parts per million in to achieve four times greater yield. And the geologic record over 600 million years shows that the average CO2 in the atmosphere is about 1,000 parts per million. So that seems to suggest that the plants have evolved to that level, and at 385 parts per million, they're malnourished. And we know that if you reduce that level of CO2, the plants will start to suffer. And at 200 parts per million, they start to die, and at 150 parts per million, they're dead. And so the focus on CO2, because it's supposedly causing the end of the planet because of runaway global warming, trying to reduce that is going to cause more harm. And that's the political agenda. And by the way, of course, this whole attack upon industry and businesses happened to suit the extreme environmentalists, the Greenpeaces, the Sierra Clubs. It suited their agenda very nicely. And so you end up with this unholy alliance between the Marie Strong group and then the environmental groups. And of course, it always amuses me when you see somebody like Andrew Weaver, who's a computer modeler of climate at the University of Victoria. He's pro-nuclear, so he's always pushed, saying CO2 is the problem, like computer models prove it. And of course, the Greens support him. Oh, he's wonderful. He's against CO2 and industry. Then when they find out he's pro-nuclear, they turn on him again. And it's almost Kafkaesque in its what's going on in the world.
All right. Well, on that note, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Ball.
Thank you for the opportunity, James.